From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. The film Medicine for Melancholy made a big splash on the Independent Film Festival circuit last year, and its writer-director, Barry Jenkins, is sitting right across from me at KQED in San Francisco. Barry, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. I mean, I saw the film at South by Southwest last year. It seemed like it was the perfect festival for a film like this.
Yeah, I think everything we did was tailored towards taking the movie to South by Southwest. We just felt like, you know, the characters in the film, the music, all those elements. You know, 20% of the bands on the soundtrack are bands that are based in Austin, which is something that really just happened by chance. So, yeah, it was great to premiere the movie there.
Now, if I can ask you to explain what the movie's about, because it's kind of a bare-bones story anyway.
Yeah, it is.
You can do that.
Yeah, it's really simple. The movie is about a guy and a girl who have a one-night stand. The movie starts the morning after. The guy wants everything to do with the girl. The girl wants nothing to do with the guy. And so, of course, they spend the next 24 hours getting to know one another and the city of San Francisco, which eventually becomes more than just the backdrop for the film, but really like the motivator and like the third character in this love triangle.
And it's interesting because, you know, whenever there is especially a male African-American character in a film, there's an accepted wisdom that he's going to be angry. And, mm-hmm. and he does carry some anger, but the anger is not about race, but in fact about his own state of being kind of lost.
It was really important to me to put these characters on the screen because I felt like I hadn't seen them in a movie or on a television show in quite some time. And I knew, you know, I had friends who were like these people and, you know, these people exist. And so it was really important to me to get that character right, but to also have him, despite the fact that he's in this world, you know, this indie world and he lives in San Francisco, he's still sort of connected to these issues, you know, of identity, of what it means to be African-American and the plight of African-Americans in the city of San Francisco. He's just constantly compartmentalizing himself. He's like, okay, I'm indie and then I'm black. So I'm black indie and then I'm black indie, but I'm black indie with a black conscience, you know? So he's always trying to further compartmentalize himself, and the character Joe, you know, she wants no part of that. So, like I said, of course they spend time together because opposites attract.
But it's funny, too, because it feels like, and we've talked about this before, this mm-hmm. weird kind of intersection of screwball comedy and Claire Denis.
Yeah, you know, the movie was originally inspired by the Claire Denis film Friday Night, which is a film about two characters who meet and have a one-night stand during a transit strike. And I felt like those characters were a generation, you know, beyond mine, my own generation. So I felt like if I adapted that premise for myself, it would be about the morning after, about younger characters, and the naivete of trying to forge an emotional connection from this physical encounter. And then we happened to cast Wyatt Cenac, who was not on The Daily Show then, but he's now, you know, one of the news correspondents on Jon Stewart's Daily Show. And he's just such a funny guy. And it was really the most comfortable way for him to enter the character was to sort of be himself. And so those elements, like you said, of screwball comedy, you know, this goofiness, you know, this really adorable, you know, aspect of this guy who's going through sort of a mental crisis, you know, they really just came out and just flowed through the script and we just ran with it.
It's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Barry Jenkins. His directorial feature debut is Medicine for Melancholy. But one of the great screwball comedy things about it is in screwball comedy, people are always explaining themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They were trying to explain themselves and getting in their own way when they explain themselves. And Wyatt, as Micah, is really doing that. I mean, he's constantly contradicting himself.
You know, I tell people all the time, if he would just shut up, he could probably get the girl, you know. Probably could get her if he could just shut up. But you're right, he's always talking, you know. And I feel like that's his way of not necessarily seducing her, but he's constantly trying to remake the introduction. I feel like as the film goes on, he tries to introduce himself over and over and over again. You know, he's like, this is who I am. And now that you know me a little bit better, this is really who I am. Until he finally gets to the point where he unleashes, you know, this torrent of some pretty dark things, you know. And that's when, like you said, the city really begins to come to the fore, because that's what's on the forefront of his mind when he meets this character of Joe.
But it's fascinating to me because it's so much, too, about the kind of loneliness African-Americans can feel mm-hmm. in San Francisco.
Yeah. You know, I was at a Q&A in New York, and someone kind of posed the same question. And I was saying, and the person was like, well, you're from the South. I don't understand how, you know, you felt, you know, this sort of a latent racism, or not necessarily racism, but you felt like an other, you know, in San Francisco. You didn't feel like an other in the South. And I was like, well, you know, in the South, you know, you pretty much know where you stand. Everyone does. You know, it's very open. Whereas in a place like San Francisco, it's something you're not really aware of because you're in this extremely diverse city. But you're only 7% of the population. So it's a diversity that does not include you. And assuming that the 7% of African Americans in San Francisco live below the poverty line, and they're kind of sort of removed to certain sections of the city, and they don't get to participate in the diversity of the city. So you're right. You know, when I got here, I felt like such an other, and it was a really strange feeling for me coming from the South, where you're always used to dealing with things in black and white. You know, you come to the city that is, you know, a tapestry of colors, but it just does not include the color African American.
It's so funny too, because this is a city unlike any place else I've ever spent time where there is no black middle class enclave, but you have two middle class characters, and it's actually a film as much about class, maybe even more so than about race.
I'm so glad you said that, because yes, when we talk about, you know, the African American presence in San Francisco, it really becomes a discussion of class. Like you were saying, there's no African American middle class, or there's a very, very small African American middle class in the city of San Francisco. And in any city, the middle class is really the segment of the population that engages the most in the local government and the local politics. And so the African Americans don't have a sense of agency in the city because the middle class is so dwindled. It's like they're talking about these things, and the character Micah is making everything on the surface seem like it's about race, but really it's class that drives the movie, and it's class that's removing African Americans from the city and not just their race. And I feel like the whole process of going through the film is him sort of learning, you know, in these discussions with Joe, that he has to recontextualize, you know, his standpoint, his viewpoint on these issues, you know, to better address them.
That's kind of where the anger comes from, because there's a part of him that just can't do that, and he's trying to convince himself as much as he is her.
You're right. He can't do it. He does not have the facilities, the mental capabilities, the wherewithal, the know-how to really understand what he's feeling. And it's frustrating, you know, and eventually, as the film mounts, you know, that frustration grows until it boils over.
Hers is a much more difficult part, because she really maintains a mystique, I would say, for the first half of the film, because he's so busy trying to sort of offer her these different poles. So he figures, as you were saying, if he slips from this to that, then somehow he'll throw out the card that she responds to.
Yeah, you know, what I really loved about Friday Night, about Miss Denise's film, and what really sort of drew me to that premise was the fact that the movie, it begins at a moment and it ends at a moment. And there's very little introduction, and there's absolutely no epilogue. You know, you meet these people in the moment and you have no idea.
And they also exist without context in the same way they do in this film.
Exactly. They exist without context. You know, you have no idea, you know, where they're coming from or where they're going to. And so in this film, in Medicine for Melancholy, the character Joe has an entire life stringing along behind her before she has this encounter with Micah. And I feel like for the first half of the film, all that's happening in the interior of the character, all these things, you know, all this context we're speaking of, is really sort of driving her. And she can't share that with Micah because she doesn't know him. Why would she? And so you're right. It's a much more difficult role for Tracy Higgins to pull off. But I think she does a great job.
She does. By the way, we're talking about the film Medicine for Melancholy. My guest is writer-director Barry Jenkins. It's The Treatment. In this interesting way, it feels like it's a 21st century film about young African Americans. I mean, that sort of sense of, and you get this because you spent time in L.A., when you walk into a room, you see a black person at a table with a bunch of white people, and you think, that's what I look like.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I mean, it's true. You know, I will say, there is something very beautiful. Every time I go to New York, I'll be walking down the street, and, you know, I'll be like in Harlem or something, and some kid will come by on a skateboard and a mohawk, a little black kid, and I'll be like, and I just love the fact that, you know, because he was born in maybe 1995, you know, in 2008, 2009, he can make those choices and decide, this is who I am. Just because I live in Harlem doesn't mean I can't have a mohawk and I can't ride a skateboard. So I think there is something to say about the 21st century African-American or young African-American identity. I think it's a self-defined identity, and I think it can be a much more dynamic identity. And I think that's where these two characters sort of enter. They're having a discussion about, you know, what it means to be young and African-American in the 21st century and how you define yourself, you know, particularly in a city like San Francisco.
Oh, absolutely, because even in Harlem, that kid making that kind of statement, he still has this cushion of being in that community. And Micah is so much trying to define himself, because without that self-definition, he sort of doesn't know who he is.
Yeah, I think even when the movie ends, he has no clue who he is. And it's weird. When you meet someone, you always want to present yourself. You know, when you meet someone, that's what you do. It's like, hey, my name is Elvis. Hi, my name is Barry. And then as you talk, you're presenting yourself to this person. And I feel like because he has no clue who he is, but he's met this woman who he obviously wants, you know, it's like he's trying to do two things at once, you know, and they're just pulling him completely apart.
I think it was really interesting that you decided to start the film the morning after the one-night stand. Did you ever give any thought to including any of that from the evening before? I mean, it's certainly alluded to throughout the entire picture.
Right. Yeah, we thought about that. I never, at the script phase, I began writing the screenplay after I decided it was going to begin the morning after. There was something about the actual act or the actual encounter about how they meet that I did not want the audience to have. You know?
Because
I felt like there's something about the mystery that we were talking about with the character Joe particularly. I think that she needs to have something that's not in the film that's completely hers. And when that happens in the actual story of the movie is when she goes to Micah's apartment. They do the thing where they both search each other on the computer, and she finds out this very crucial piece of information about Micah's ex-girlfriend, you know, that his ex-girlfriend was white, you know. But she never gives him that information. She never tells him that she knows those things. And I feel like from that moment forward, she's in a position of power, you know.
Because he's been judging her because she has a white boyfriend.
Exactly, you know. And it would be, you know, it would be justified for her to tell him that she knows these things. But I feel like she takes the position of power and goes, you know what, I'm bigger than this, you know. And I also feel like it's the reason why she can take, you know, most of the things he says, because she realizes it's coming from a place of bitterness. I feel like the same thing is happening with the audience. When you come into a film and you really don't have the context of knowing, okay, well, you know, how drunk were they when they met? You know, were they drunk at all? You know, you really don't know the situation of how they met. You can only see their physical interactions the morning after. And I feel like that was more potent to get an audience to believe in the story.
But you still get that sense of sexual chemistry between the two of them, even though we haven't seen that act happen.
Well, they're both sexy, so that helps.
And this is the director saying that, so I guess he would know. But you still get that sense of that there's that thing that's keeping them together in the first place, even though, fascinatingly enough, you almost make him the ingenue in the piece rather than her.
And that has a lot to do with just Wyatt himself.
Really?
I really do believe so. I believe Wyatt brought so much to this role that wasn't necessarily on the page. You know, there were things he did, you know, just his gestures, his physical movements that really brought the character alive in a certain way that people do fall in love with him as they watch the film, despite the fact that he begins to say these things that are in some ways quite ugly.
I have to ask you, the film's played with many African-American audiences, because I saw the South By. It was obviously a predominantly white audience.
Yeah.
But how does it play with black audiences?
It's been amazing. We screened at the Philadelphia International Film Festival, and that was a predominantly black audience, and that was great. People had me sign the backs of the ticket stubs afterwards. And this one couple said, yeah, we met in college when we went to see She's Gotta Have It, and we haven't felt this way about a film since then. And then the movie screened at the IFC Center in New York. It opened January 30th. And it was overwhelmingly just amazing. It's just like people feel like they see themselves in these characters, you know, which is the highest compliment any of us involved with the film can get.
It's because I think that these aren't archetypal black characters, and that's what we tend to get in movies. And I think people want to see something that feels more relatable than what they've been given.
Yeah, and you know, and it was important to start from a point where they just weren't archetypal characters in general. You know, I feel like they just happen, not they just happen to be black, because I think being African-American is a very crucial part of the film. But at the same time, you know, I feel like they're talking about these things. They're talking about race, and you would assume they agree on everything. But just because they're African-American doesn't mean they're the same people. You know, I feel like the issues are more dynamic because they're two black characters talking about these issues of African-American identity, these issues of race as it pertains to San Francisco. It makes it a bit more dynamic that they don't agree, because you see there are many different kinds of African-Americans, you know, and I think we present two different kinds in this film.
We'll take a break. My guest is writer-director Barry Jenkins. His feature-length debut was Medicine for Melancholy. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Barry Jenkins. We're talking about his debut feature film, Medicine for Melancholy. There is a kind of black middle class that we don't see in movies. Mm-hmm. And you must have felt that lack yourself.
Well, I'd been writing screenplays. You know, sort of, I'd left L.A. and I was trying to figure out a way to make a movie. Then I realized, well, I have to make it very simple. You know, it has to be about two people. And so I went to Miss Denise's premise, and I was riding my bike down the street here in San Francisco. And across the street, there was an African-American woman, a black girl, riding her bike, you know, in the opposite direction. So we were approaching one another. I looked across the road. She looked across the road, and I just nodded my head. And she nodded her head. And I was like, oh, there's going to be black people in my movie riding bikes. Because you just don't see two African-American people riding bikes, you know, down the street in a movie. And so I felt like there was a niche. There was a need to present those images to people because they're true. They're factual, actual images. You know, black people listen to rock music and they ride bikes, you know, and they have aquariums, you know, all these other little things that we have in the film.
It's also, too, about desperation. And I wondered if you felt like, because that's not so much a part of what Claire Denis did in Friday Night. It's, mm-hmm. it was more about anxiety than desperation.
Right.
And it feels like here, at least on his behalf, there really is that.
I think there's an extreme desperation. You know, the character Mike, you know, we kind of drop it in the film, but he says he's born and raised in San Francisco. And so he's a character, he's probably my age. He's 28, so he's born in 79. In 1979, San Francisco was probably about 24-25% African American, with a considerable portion of that 25% living in the middle class. So he's seen the entire wave of people like himself dwindling in numbers in the city. And so you're right, he is desperate. You know, he's extremely desperate because I think he feels like he can see 10 years into the future where there'll only be two of him in the city. And so when the character Joe comes his way, he's like, okay, let's huddle up. I'm going to grab you. We're going to huddle up. And we're going to make this work, you know. And so, yeah, he is desperate.
When I think about Claire Denis's films, she's often dealt with African-Americans.
Mm-hmm, she has,
yeah. In Paris, at some point, they find community. Mm-hmm. And that community becomes this kind of family. And you really get the feeling that he wants as much as anything to have that kind of extended family that you're talking about mm-hmm. that looks like him.
You know, as much as it is a romance and as much as he wants her, as a lover, I think he wants her to sort of come and sit by his side and go, yes, I agree. Everything you're saying, I see it too. You know, he's looking for someone to say, I see it too. Okay, great. Let's see it together. I think that's his mode, you know. Miss Denise films, you're right. It's always about community. I love her cinema. I am not Claire Denis. I probably have to make about 20 more films before I get there. She is amazing. And I think in most very good cinema, that's about people's sort of struggles with identity or with class or, you know, with all these sort of socio-political, socio-economic issues. It always comes down to community.
But we should say, too, this is a comedy as much as anything else. We're going to sound a lot more serious
than
that.
I know. I was just thinking that, man. Yeah. It's hella funny. You know, why does a Bill Cosby impression, you know, in this movie about gentrification and housing rights, there's a grand Cosby impression.
But the funny thing to me in the movie is the angriest people in the movies is this activist couple who just kind of take him to task. That's really funny and a great twist on what we would expect in a movie like this.
They're at the taco truck after the club and they're about to, you know, get something to eat late at night, and these two guys walk up. And when I first wrote the script, it was going to be these two guys coming up to sell them weed, because that's what would happen in San Francisco at 2 in the morning. The guys would come up to you at the taco truck, you know, be like, hey, you know, sell you a bag. But instead, I was like, you know what? I'm not going to do that. So we have these two guys come up, and they sell them kombucha. And every time the movie screens, people just die laughing. I mean, it is by far the funniest bit. And those are two guys I worked with here in San Francisco at Banana Republic. And the way we film it like this sort of quasi-Boys in the Hood moment. It's really menacing. And you're right. You know, it's like every time the movie is about to get a little bit too serious, we give the audience a little bit of levity because we do want it to be entertaining. And I think it is an entertaining film.
Given that the movie is so desaturated of color, mm-hmm. even though it is a fantasy, that lack of color in the film strikes a certain chord. When you see something that's almost black and white, it, mm-hmm. it strikes you as being more realistic than not.
Yeah, you know, we did the color in the film, primarily James Laxon, the cinematographer, and I. We wanted to present this depiction of San Francisco that, A, was rooted in the characters in our film, and that, B, really reflected what we felt like was the tone of the film and the tone that I, when I wrote the movie, sort of felt in the city, you know, how San Francisco inspired me. And so we knew we were going to desaturate the image. We didn't want the Golden Gate Bridge. We didn't want Fisherman's Wharf. We didn't want these very bright and beautiful sort of colors that you always see in San
Francisco.
You don't
want to seduce people with that. You want them to pay attention to the people.
Exactly. We want them to pay attention to the people. And we also wanted them to see how the city is affecting the characters, or really vice versa, you know, how the characters feel about San Francisco. And it's a very muted, I feel like, reception that particularly the character Micah has to his home city at this point that we meet him in the film. And so we desaturated the image. And there are certain moments in the film when there's more color than others. And it's when the characters are just being really intuitive and they're sort of just responding to one another. And all these issues of housing rights and gentrification and African-American identity aren't affecting them, and they're really just being in the moment.
It's The Treatment. My guest is writer-director Barry Jenkins. We're talking about his debut feature film, Medicine for Melancholy. It seemed like there was a need, a hunger, I think, for a lot of people for a romantic comedy that doesn't work in conventional terms.
I really enjoy romantic comedies. You know, I was on a plane the other day, and The Devil Wears Prada was on, and I watched it, and I was like, man, this is not too bad. But a lot of those movies, they don't have any relevance, you know, to the real world. You know, you could move them in time and place and they would not be affected. And I feel like that's to the detriment, you know, of any film, but particularly to that genre. I feel like the reason why people feel like they can toss those movies away is because they're not rooted in a time and a place. You take a movie like When Harry Met Sally. It's very much rooted in New York City, you know, in the 80s. But you're right. This is a romantic comedy, but it has some heft. You know, it's politically engaged. You know, it's socially active. And it takes place in a real-world setting. You know, this movie cannot take place in Chicago or New York. It has to take place in San Francisco. I think because of that, people sort of, they don't get past the rom-com elements, but I think they embrace the movie and they accept it on its own terms, you know?
Well, because I think what people are looking for is a kind of complexity that doesn't exist. And you talk about this film being a fantasy, but most of those romantic comedies are kind of fantasies. And you know, at some point, it doesn't matter how disparate the protagonists are, they're going to end up together. And each scene plays and it ends with a question mark.
Right.
And it could almost end at any point because of those question marks that they end with.
You know, and I have been told that it probably should end at several points. but no, you're right. But, you know, but when you meet someone, it's true. You know, you're on a date or, you know, maybe you have a one-night stand and you spend the next day with somebody and you don't know how much more time am I going to have with this person. It was really important, you know, to get that into the film. You know, that's sort of, you know, this ticking clock. It's like, you know, how much more time is Micah going to have with her? You know, is he going to be able to woo her? Is she going to warm up to him? And you're right. There should be different levels in the film where you feel like, okay, that's it. It's going to end. It's done. You know, they're not going to get out of that club. She's just going to get in the cab and go home. That really helps the film. And it's actually one of the things I'm really proud of, that people ask me about the ending all the time. It's like, oh, why didn't they get together? Or blah, blah, blah. Why didn't they this? Why didn't they that? I'm like, I don't know. You know, this is the reality of the scenario I felt, you know, I was presenting.
Because I think what really finally makes the movie work so well is there's a series of, first of all, it plays like it. These are all anecdotes, but in fact, it's pretty well worked out. And but also, there's a what next, kind of like the end of each one of these sort of sequences where what's going to happen?
In any movie, you want those moments. You know, you don't want people to feel like they're on this huge arc. You know, you want them to feel like, okay, I'm walking down the street, I look this way, something interesting catches my eye, I'm paying attention to this now, then I'm going to keep walking, you know. And, you know, a street is a story, you know, and there should be several different points, you know, on that street that capture your attention, you know, as compellingly as anyone that came before it or after it. You shouldn't be waiting until the third act, you know, to be captivated, you know.
But part of the stuff with Joe is that because she's so often silent, she's almost like a dream figure for him anyway. I mean, that sort of thing where if you're chasing a dream, it doesn't really articulate itself to you.
Yeah, and I have to say, I have to give props to our cinematographer, James Laxton, and to Tracy on that. You know, Tracy is doing a lot of the acting in this film just with her face, you know, just with her facial expressions or lack thereof. And James did a great job with limited resources of really capturing those moments because she's performing, you know, entire beats without a single line of dialogue. You know, at some points they both are.
Did you have a moment where you where she had more dialogue and you decided to cut it just because it was better to have her not say much?
You know, honestly, man, you're sharp. The opening scene in the film, in the bathroom, there's a lot of dialogue in that scene, and we ended up cutting all of it and just playing the scene on their faces. Part of that was because we didn't have any rehearsals, and they got to San Francisco 12 hours before we shot the first shot. We shot the movie in sequence, so it worked out. You know, these people don't know each other. They're not going to talk right at first. But there were several moments where We just felt like the movie could play without the words, you know, or the movie could play without so much coverage, you know, because the actual things that the characters were doing, that Wyatt and Tracy were doing on set, just with their bodies, they told the story, you know.
But it also must have meant, too, you must have found pretty early on that you really trusted your actors.
I had no choice, man. I did trust them, but I had no choice, you know. I mean, I was a first-time director. I mean, we were all first-timers, you know, myself, the cinematographer, the editor, all first-timers. And so, yeah, we had to trust everybody, you know. I couldn't have these people, you know, dancing a tightrope. I had to trust and believe in what they were bringing to the characters. And for the most part, they both brought amazing, overwhelmingly positive things to their characters.
It's the treatment, I guess, as writer-director Barry Jenkins. His directorial feature debut is Medicine for Melancholy. Because it's almost like what he has is a series of monologues. He can almost perform his part without her being in the film.
You know, it's true. It's true. Yeah, he probably could. And he would do a great job. But again, it's like I feel like Tracy is almost like a mirror for the audience, you know. I feel like Micah, the character of Wyatt's playing, is driving this film. And Tracy is the audience on screen, you know, not reacting, you know, sometimes not participating, but really just going, like this face you're giving me right now. Just thinking, you know.
I was at that face.
What is going on? You know, how is this going to end up? You know, how is this playing and why is he doing these things?
As a first timer, although you've done shorts before, it has like a lot of big movie moments in it. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting to me to do that in this kind of circumstance with these sort of limited resources. The great moments come from the actors.
You know, we decided not to really restrict ourselves. You know, we knew we had a very small box we were working within physically, you know, from a craft standpoint. There were only a certain amount of things that we could pull off. But once we defined what those things were, we really just opened everything up. Wyatt and I were house-sitting this house in the marina while we were making the film. And at some point I decided, you know, we're going to put it in the movie. Didn't tell the people I was house-sitting for. We're just going to shoot in this house where the character Jo is staying, where her boyfriend, who's in London, is staying. That was a house-sitting gig I got. That house is physically in the marina, which is like, you know, the old money sort of Tony section of San Francisco, a.k.a. the whitest section of San Francisco. And so in the process of us just living there, Wyatt really ingested, you know, what the marina meant, you know, in the context of this film and the context of these two characters and the lives they lead. So later in the movie, we had a blocking problem where Wyatt had to move this bike. And I was like, well, Wyatt, I need you to move the bike because later on when she comes out of the bathroom, blah, 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 it has to be on this side of the room. It's like, okay, I got you. So we get the shot up. We start moving the bike. And Wyatt delivers the best ad-lib in the film by far. He goes, oh, you should get yourself a fixed-gear bike. You'd be like Mae Jemison, first black woman to ride a fixed-gear bike through the marina. Then he goes, hell, you're probably the first black woman in the marina. And it's beautiful, and it completely ties all these different elements that we're playing with, you know, in this film, all these issues of African-American identity, you know, the class struggle, housing rights. All those things become tied together in this one ad-lib by Wyatt. And it's all driven by the fact that he was physically living with me in the marina, and he ingested those things, and he brought them out in the character, in a scene. So you're right. I mean, the performances, at sometimes, they really just take off and take a life of their own, and I just really trusted those guys to do things like that.
Oh, what a time, Barry. Thank you so much for being in this. It's a terrific movie.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
My guest is Barry Jenkins, writer-director for the film Medicine for Melancholy. Our recording engineer at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with assistance from Howard Gelman at KQED in San Francisco. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.